Chapter 12. Jim Ferguson, on his first errand that morning, left his house and drove to the Bank of America. There he transferred his money, except for $10, from his savings account to his checking account. As he left the bank, he looked into his commercial passbook and read with satisfaction the sum $41,475. Should he go back home? He wanted to be dressed right. I guess maybe I'll stop and get a new tie, he told himself. One of those narrow ties. So he drove along San Pablo until he saw a clothing store. Parking, he got out, taking care to move slowly and not to exert himself too much. Soon he was inside the store, examining the ties in the rack by the coats. A plump young Chinese man in shirt sleeves came towards him, smiling. Good day, he said to Ferguson. He had on a good-looking tie, gray, with bits of red. The old man, searching, found a tie exactly like it in the group. It cost $4.50, which seemed to him a lot for a tie. That's a nice one, the Chinese man said. That's handmade by a fellow over in Sausalito. He's got a patent on it. Ferguson bought several ties and left the store, feeling pleased. But he still did not want to go home. Lydia was there, and he felt nervous at the idea of running into her. Seated in his car, he opened the paper bag of ties. By use of the rearview mirror, he began to fasten one of the new ties around the collar of his shirt. While he worked at it, he wore ties so seldom that his fingers got in the way and he could not make out the length to let the small end fall. He realized that the Chinese man had come out of his store onto the sidewalk and was nodding to him sympathetically. So he got out of his car and let the Chinese man fix the tie. The man did a good job, and his fingers felt deft and friendly.
Thanks, Ferguson said, a little embarrassed but at the same time gratified. I have this big business appointment I have to get to.
He looked at his pocket watch to show how much pressure there was on him. The Chinese smiled at him and watched him get back into the car and start up. He wishes me luck, Ferguson thought as he drove away into traffic.
It's a good sign.
Now he felt better than he had in months.
This is really an occasion, he said to himself.
He had bought over $25 worth of ties, he realized.
Wow, that was something. That proved something. That's a service they do, he thought. Those Chinese. That's how they make those little businesses pay. They add something extra for nothing that a white man won't do. I wouldn't mind going in there for all my clothes. I know I'd get real individual attention.
He made a note of the location.
So I can find it again, he thought. I'll bet that Chinese guy has made a lot of money, he thought as he made a left turn at an intersection. This is really a nice day, he said to himself as he noticed the sky and the sun.
He rolled down the car window and sniffed the air.
I hope that damn smog doesn't show up, he thought. That really slays people. It causes lung cancer as much as cigarettes. I can't feel this good all day, he said to himself.
Already he was beginning to feel tired. The driving was hard on him, the having to watch other cars, the stops and starts.
That's what makes the smog, he thought.
The car exhausts,
all these buses and trucks, too many people moving into Oakland, too overcrowded.
Now he felt the weight of an enormous flu come onto him. It was like the time he had been laid up with the Asiatic virus. He had had it a week before he had realized that he was sick because the symptoms of the thing did not so much make him feel different as just worse. It had made his fatigue greater, his irritability greater, his gloom, his sense of defeat more overwhelming. He had gone around snapping at everyone and been unable to do his work. He had stayed on his feet, and then one morning he had been too tired to get up from the breakfast table. So Lydia had kept him home.
Like that again, he thought, slowing his car.
heavy all over, his arms in particular. His hands flopped like cement gloves on the wheel. His head wobbled. Even my eye muscles, he thought. His view of the traffic ahead became disfigured. Objects merged and then separated.
My goddamn left eye is swimming off on its own, he realized. Wall-eyed. Muscles must be pooped.
Well, he thought,
what I need is vitamin B1. That's nerve vitamin.
Keeping his car in motion, he continued on until he could turn back on San Pablo. He made a left turn against a red light and swung over to the far lane.
That's what took care of me before, he said to himself. That and a couple of good steam baths.
But he could not go get into a steam bath this time because of his being taped up. He had to stay out of the water. The doctor had warned him. The vitamin would have to do. There was a yellow zone in front of the drive-in, and he parked there. Getting out, he carefully made his way up the sidewalk to the health food store. His feet, he discovered, seemed to sink down into the sidewalk, as if the pavement had become ooze.
Sinking down a full 6 inches, he said to himself, lifting his right foot back and up, setting it down again, lifting his left, right, left, and so on to the screen door of the health food store.
Stuck there, for a moment he rested, grinned to himself with anger, and then opened the door with the side of his hand.
"Morning, Jim,"
Betty said. He sat down, dropping abruptly and grunting on the first stool. He folded his arms on the counter and rested his head for a moment. He had done that years ago in school. He felt his forehead pressing his wrist.
Like in the third grade, he thought. Midday nap.
He beckoned to Betty and she came over.
"Listen," he said. "How about a bottle of those health vitamins again? Those therapy vitamins."
"Oh, now what did you have?" Betty murmured. "Was it the Theragrams?"
She moved away to the shelf.
"Big red pills?"
He saw the bottle he wanted, pointed to it. She got it down.
"I remember," she said, "the B complex, the niacinamide and pantheol group. This is very good, Jim. This has the liver fraction in it. They use it with anemic people, but it doesn't have the B12 in it. That's the only drawback."
She reached for another bottle.
"This has your B12, but it's a little more expensive. They're both hematinic formulas."
She eyed him, holding up both bottles.
"I just want the nerve one," he said. "B1.
He reached out for the familiar bottle, and she handed it to him.
"Can I have some water?" he said.
"Yes,"
she said, going to fill a glass. He took two of the vitamin pills there at the counter, and then, carrying the bottles, started from the store.
"We'll put it on your bill," Betty said, following after him. "I hope that does what you want, Jim. You do look very tired today. You know, you could take it as an elixir. You might find that handier."
She came out on the sidewalk with him.
"Right,"
he said, making his way to his car and getting into it. As soon as he had sat down again, he felt better. Some of the weight left him.
"That goddamn smog," he thought as he started up the car. "It really is hard to breathe anymore." And the smog, he saw, had begun to blot out the colors of the buildings.
San Pablo did not go on nearly as far now. It cut off in the haze, and he could not see downtown Oakland as he had been able to just a few minutes before.
"But who cares?" he asked himself as he drove out into traffic. "I've seen downtown Oakland."
Up in the Oakland Hills, there would not be so much smog anyhow.
"That's why they live up there," he told himself as he drove along a main street in an eastwardly direction.
He did not know the street, but it had a bus line running along it, so it had to go through to Broadway.
"I'll turn left on Broadway," he decided, "and that'll take me clear out to Piedmont. Then I won't have any trouble after that."
Sure enough, the street at last came out on Broadway. And now, as he drove toward the intersection with MacArthur,
He noticed that the smog had fallen behind.
They wouldn't let it get up here, he told himself with pleasure. There's probably a zoning law against it.
At that, he laughed to himself, feeling better once more. The vitamins had helped already. The clean air gave him back his ability to breathe and the vitamins his strength. He patted his coat pocket, the bank book, and the checkbook.
Hot dog, he said to himself. This is going to be something.
At MacArthur, he turned right, then left onto a long, tree-lined residential street. Now there was almost no traffic. The noise fell away behind him, and he slowed, aware of the peacefulness of the neighborhood. Piles of leaves in the gutters waiting to be burned. A parked milk truck. Gardener at work, old jeans and sweatshirt, clipping the edge of a lawn. Ferguson drove in second gear up the hill past larger houses, iron fences, ivy. He searched for the house.
This street, wasn't it?
He craned his neck to see back. High stone wall, the poplar trees.
Had he passed it?
He made out a street sign.
Wrong street. Not there yet.
Picking up speed, he turned right.
Warm,
he thought. Sun streamed down on him on the sidewalk. The tie, too, made him hot. His neck had become slippery within the tight collar. With his left thumb, he loosened it by stretching it, still buttoned.
And the car here, it was on. He bent to switch it off.
A crash threw him forward and against the steering wheel. His head banged and his hands went out, hitting the windshield. He bounced back and lay hunched down, open-mouthed. The car had stopped. The motor was dead. Ahead of him, a great, heavy, white Chrysler was stalled with its front fender locked into his. And out of the Chrysler, the driver, stepping rapidly, was shaking his fist and yelling with no sound.
A woman,
the old man realized. A thin woman in a long brown coat, angry, scared, hurrying toward him.
Do you see what you did?
Her face shaking broke into being at his window, an inch from his own. He rolled the window down.
Look what you did. My God, what'll my husband say?
She dropped away, falling to see the fender.
Oh, my God, look at it.
Numbly, he managed to get out onto the street. Other cars had stopped. The street now was blocked. His car and the woman's car blocked it completely because of the solid row of parked cars on each side.
Look!
Her whole body was shaking.
And I have to pick him up at 1:30. It's your fault. You were driving in the middle of the street. You didn't even see me. Did you hear me honk my horn? You didn't look up. You were looking down. You weren't looking at all or paying any attention.
No, he said.
Well, don't just stand there, she said, staring at him. Do something. Get them apart.
She walked off and then got back into her car. Then all at once she was out again. He could not keep track of her. She was already back beside him.
Will you do something, or are you just going to stand there?
He squatted down and peered sightlessly at the two fenders. His mind was empty. He had no plan or notion of what to do. Behind him, the woman said,
I could just kill you. Don't you know how to drive? In 10 minutes, I have to be at the Claremont Hotel. I'll never make it now. Will you call a tow truck? I want your license number.
She ran back to her car to find something to write on. Ferguson groped at the fenders. One of the cars would have to be jacked up.
Are you insured?
The woman said, returning.
I suppose not. They never are. I'm going over to that house and phone for a cab. I have your license number now.
She left. He saw her hurry up the path to the front porch of the house and begin ringing the bell. After a moment, he returned his attention to the two fenders. A man coming up beside him said, Need a hand?
No, Ferguson said. Thanks.
Want me to call a tow truck?
No,
he said. Going to the trunk of his car, he got out the jack. Then he opened the trunk of the Chrysler and lifted out the larger Chrysler jack. With the two, he raised the front end of the Chrysler. The fenders were still interlocked. Kneeling, he let the air out of the front tires of his Pontiac.
With a sigh, the Pontiac gradually settled. The old man took hold of the bent green fender of the Pontiac and tore at it. The metal gave at last, and the two cars were free. He threw the jacks back into the cars and made his way down the path to the house where the woman had gone. The front door was open. He could see the woman at a telephone in the hallway. The owner of the house, another woman, appeared.
"Tell her she can drive,"
the old man gasped. Turning, he walked back up the path, away from the house. The woman driver appeared, still pale and shaking.
"Thanks very much," she said icily.
"I got them apart." He fumbled in his wallet. His fingers were so stiff that they seemed about to crack open. "I'm giving you my business card." She snatched the card away from him and hopped into her Chrysler. Its engine started and she drove off, the car swerving from side to side and then disappearing in a corner. The other cars that had stopped began to go again. The man who had offered to help him remained, however. His small foreign car was parked in a driveway.
"What about your car?" he said. "You have two flats."
"I can make it," the old man said. "I run a garage. That's the card I gave that lady. My garage card."
"I see," the man said. "Well, good luck."
He got awkwardly back into his foreign car. "So long." By himself, Ferguson pushed his Pontiac from the street over to the curb. It blocked two driveways, but now traffic could get past.
"They actually could get by anyhow," he told himself. "They just stopped to rubberneck, the bastards. It doesn't matter to them if I get a ticket for leaving my car like it is."
But there was nothing else he could do. He was not far from Mr. Harmon's house, and so he began to walk along the sidewalk, not even stopping to get back his breath. Red specks dipped in front of his eyes, and his throat burned. As he walked, he breathed through his mouth great windy gasps that startled two people passing him. He grinned at them and continued on.
"I only got about a block to go," he said to himself.
Already he thought he could see the house and he could get onto the grounds from this end. He could cut across and save walking. "Yes," he thought.
"There it was."
A truck was parked in front of it. Harmon's truck. It had the name of the record business on it, so he knew he was right. This was the place at last. Going from the sidewalk onto the grass, he climbed towards a terrace of roses. He did not try to find the flagstone path. He did not have the time.
"I have to go right in there," he told himself. "I have this big business deal to conclude with them. I can't afford to wait."
Now he scrambled up between trees.
"That was something like this."
He clutched at his coat to be sure his checkbook and passbook were safe. Crossing the rose garden, he slipped and fell backward, sitting down suddenly and wheezing. He got up almost at once, staggering and brushing at himself. His coat was dirty. He went on three more steps, and then he slipped again. This time he slid. His feet went in different directions, and he floundered forward, reaching with both hands to touch the soil for support. Running a few steps, balancing himself with his fingers, he reached the concrete front porch. Bits of dirt and fertilizer trailed after him, bouncing from the concrete. Trembling with pain, he wiped his hands together, standing on the porch by the front door. He wiped his feet. And then, after he had stood for a time and gotten his breath back, when he felt that he could talk, he would have to be able to talk. He had to wait until he could do that. He reached out and began to knock. Inside the house, someone stirred.
"I knocked too soon," he thought. "I won't be able to talk." He could not even get his breath yet, so how could he talk? He felt panic. "It's too soon," he said to himself. The person was coming to the door. "Don't come yet," he said to himself. "If I don't knock anymore, you won't come, okay?"
He stood without knocking, making no sound except for his breathing. But they were still coming anyhow.
"You bastards," he said to himself. "You caught me at the wrong time. I'm not ready."
But there was nothing he could do.
He could not stop them now. The door began to open. "Hello," he said. "Hello, can I come in? Is Mr. Harmon here?" He practiced faster and faster, flying along as the door opened, flying with it. "Say, I came to see Mr. Harmon, if he isn't busy. This is really important." He patted his coat, patted his checkbook, patted the pane. "We have business," he said. He wheezed on faster to himself, like a thing. His head, like a cuckoo, went back and forth in rhythm with the door. "Hello, hello, hello," he said. "Hello." The door all the way open. A woman, well-dressed, elegant, smiling sideways with her hand, ring fingers on the door, pale red nails, carpet in the hall and table, curved arch, seeing in, seeing past, fireplace. "Hello," he babbled. I'm sorry. Sorry it happened. Hot around my neck where the new tie is. Reached for heater. The sun came down on him, cracking him, splitting his head wide open. I'll get it out of there, but I can't back. Maybe you can back it. Sorry, sorry," he said to the woman. He backed away from her, retreating. "Yes?" she said. "Hot," he said. "Can I sit for a minute?" "Have my bottle of pills. Hemotetic." He laughed. They both laughed, and she held the door for him so he could pass on into the cool, dim hallway with no sound at all, lost in the carpet. White Spanish walls, 1,000 years old. He did not even dare to breathe. "My husband's here," she said from ahead of him as she walked. "I think if you want to wait..." "Thanks," he said, finding a chair. Black leather. His hands passed over it, knowing it.
"Just a minute."
Her back to him at the other wide archway, the far room. Drapes. "I'll be fine," he said, seated.
"You're sure?"
"Yes," he said. "Thanks." He stared at the floor. Then in his hands balanced a china cup of coffee, spoon and all. He stared at it in horror. It flopped and slid and returned. A single black drop, as large as gum, shot down the side of his leg, streaking the pants. He fixed his eyes on it, nodding. Out of sight. "What you don't know..." He crossed his leg to hide.
"Don't you worry," the woman said.
"Oh, hell no," he said, keeping himself from laughing. "Don't you worry about me." He rocked from side to side. "It's the way I am. Like a boat. You'll get used to it." Al Miller said, "Honor is the thing you must have, like credit in the financial world. A check goes through 20 hands before any real money is involved. My point is that honor has to be taken for granted the same way we take the check as being good. Otherwise, the whole system falls apart." Stretched out in his bathrobe, his eyes hidden by his dark glasses, Chris Harmon gazed up at the midday sky. He did not respond. He seemed to be meditating.
"You mean within an organization?" Bob Ross said.
"Exactly," Al said.
Harmon, raising his head, said slowly, "But someone can get into an organization, Al, someone who has other purposes." Reaching, he located his drink. "You can't go on blind trust. You have to protect yourself."
"I don't think you understand how close they are to us all the time."
"Pardon?"
Al said, not following.
Supporting himself on his elbows, Harmon said, "Most of what we net, or should net, has to go back in. Reinvestment, but for this purpose, to protect ourselves. I suppose you read where SP has been quietly buying up Western Pacific stock.
The first WP knew about it was when SP suddenly announced they already had 10%, and so help me God, they were applying to the ICC to acquire the remainder. My God, they'd be taking over.
Really dreadful,
Ross said. But that's not the only way an organization is penetrated, Harmon said. There are also spies and informers and plants, as in the auto business, where all secrets are swiped.
I can testify to that, Al said, from my experience.
Absolutely, Harmon agreed. You're canny. But I've seen other things, Al, which you may not know about. Let me give you an example. Keep this one to yourself, of course. He glanced toward Ross.
Bob knows about this.
Oh, yeah, Ross said soberly. That contact.
Harmon said, we were sounded out.
Who by?
Al said, trying to make it sound as if he followed. But in fact, he had long ago lost the thread of the discussion. Both Harmon and Ross seemed to take the thing for granted.
By them, Harmon said. They were, let's face it, probing for a weak link in us.
They didn't find it, but they'll keep on trying. They've got a lot of money. They're not SP, of course, but they're also not the pipe tobacco shop on the corner. By that I mean they're not fly by night in any sense. They're here to stay.
I see, Al said.
You have to know your friends, Ross said.
Exactly, Harmon said.
Now, we're all friends here, the three of us. But you'll be approached. Removing his dark glasses, he gazed directly at Al. You will, one of these days.
For Christ's sake, Al said.
And you won't even know it, Ross said.
No, Harmon said, not off the bat.
Tell him about the contact, Ross said.
Harmon said, I knew it right off, but only because it's happened before, and because I've made out their line, their logic.
Mainly, they operate from out of town, probably from Delaware, through a holding company. Assuming they have a legitimate front at all, they probably control all their own retail outlets.
They sell to themselves, Ross said.
But what do they actually want or do? Harmon said. We don't know. They've been out here on the West Coast for at least 11 months, I would judge, gathering by the changes in the picture, especially in Marin County. You read probably about the enormous new public housing that opened in Marin City? Really elaborate structures. The taxpayers are paying, and Berkeley's ruined by them. They've practically taken over the city in toto. It's taken 15 years, but it's done now. He grimaced at Al.
Who?
Al said.
Negroes,
Bob Ross said.
Harmon said, that was what gave their contact away. Even on the phone, the voice was recognizable. The Negro intonation.
Al stared at him. They had a deal, Harmon went on. A very calm, direct one. I played along. His voice now seemed to shake. I acted as if I had no idea what they were talking about, you see, so it misfired. Again he grimaced. It was almost a tic. I'm still tense, thinking back to it, he said. He sipped the rest of his drink. Anyhow, he said, they had hold of some factor they thought they could use to make their entry. We'd have to come to terms. Then they could absorb us and run us.
That'll be the day, Bob Ross said.
Harmon shrugged. You never know, he said. They've got a lot they can bring to bear.
Time will tell.
Up to this point, they've soft-pedaled it. Maybe they're groping around in the dark a little, too.
Or maybe they're letting us dangle, Ross murmured, to get more kicks out of it.
It's a dirty business they're in, Harmon said. Blackmail, a dirty approach to the market. He became silent.
Why Negroes? Al said.
It goes a long way back, Harmon said.
There was a particular Negro folk singer. We were operating on a shoestring back around 1940, just before the war in San Francisco. He glanced at his wristwatch. Someday when we have the time, I'll tell it to you, the whole story.
But we have a job to do right now, Ross said, rising to his feet and setting down his glass. We've got a trip ahead.
I wonder if he's still alive, Harmon said.
Who? Ross said.
Shoeless Lacey Conkway, five-string banjo. He was in the same prison as Leadbetter. Leadbelly, as you know him. I met Leadbelly a number of times before his death. In fact, we did a couple of Leadbelly albums. Ross said, and a Shoeless Lacey Conkway album. The two men glanced at each other somberly.
You mean this raccoon banjo player is after you?
Al said.
All this time?
It was the call from Tootie Doolittle, all right. They had imagined it was someone else for obvious good reason.
Why don't you have him plugged?
He demanded. They both laughed, Ross and Harmon. And then Harmon, in a slow, introspective voice, said, Al, they may be after me, but we will get to them first, as you suggest. Don't kid yourself on that score. There's too much at stake. The door from the house opened, and a woman came out onto the patio, a stately, gray-haired woman whom Al Miller identified at once as Mrs. Harmon. Going up to her husband, she said,
Chris, there's a man to see you who's waiting in the living room now, but he's acting very strangely.
Her voice had a tense quality. She smiled briefly at Ross and then at Al.
Maybe you'd better...
She leaned down to confer with Harmon, and her voice became blurred. All right, Harmon said, getting to his feet. What kind of man? He glanced at Ross. Have you ever seen him before? Ross said,
Maybe we'd better not take off just yet.
He shot a glance at Al.
I've never seen him before, Mrs. Harmon said.
This is Al Miller, Harmon explained to her, indicating Al. He's working for us currently. This is Mrs. Harmon, Al. Rubbing his chin, he said, What did he come for? What did he say?
There's something wrong with him, I think, Mrs. Harmon said to Bob Ross.
It may be that he's drunk, she added. An older man, about 60. Harmon started into the house, but at the door he paused and turned to say something more to Al. You'll see a lot, he said, from now on. It'll be good experience. You'll see what I mean about the problems we were discussing. The problems the organization faces and has to keep so constantly in mind.
We'll come inside with you, Ross said.
I wish you would, Mrs. Harmon said. The four of them walked through the house to the living room. It was a beautiful house, and Al's attention was caught by first one aspect of it and then another. He trailed behind and was the last to arrive in the living room. He had to peer past the others to see. There, seated on the couch, wearing a suit and tie with a cup and saucer on his knee, smiling straight ahead of him, sat Jim Ferguson. He did not seem aware of them. He continued to stare fixedly ahead. His suit, Al saw, had mud on it, and his face was inflamed and streaked with sweat. At once, seeing him, Harmon began booming out cordially.
Jim! I'll be goddamned!
He made a motion, and Mrs. Harmon at once withdrew. Ross moved off to one side to become inconspicuous. The old man turned his head and saw Harmon. With tremulous, slow care, he set down his coffee cup and saucer. They clinked together. He rose to his feet and came a couple of steps towards Harmon. Holding out his hand, he said in a hoarse voice, Hello there, Harmon.
For Christ's sake, Al said. You here?
He was taken completely by surprise. The old man made out Al. He pointed his finger at him and began to laugh. His face, red and puffy, lit up as he laughed. He tried to speak, but seemed unable to. He continued to point at Al, his finger wavering, as if there was something he kept wanting to put across. but the harder he tried to express it, the further it eluded him.
I'll be goddamned,
the old man managed at last. Spitting, wiping his mouth, he again broke into laughter, mostly convulsions of his face, with very little sound.
Listen, he said, moving towards Al. Did you write that letter?
What letter? Al said.
That.
He paused, choking.
That anonymous letter.
Hell no, Al said. I don't know anything about any letter. Harmon, in a pleasant conversational voice, said, Was there an anonymous letter, Jim, concerning me?
Yes, Ferguson said.
Ross said something unintelligible and began pacing around, off by himself, clenching and unclenching his fists. Well, Harmon said. He continued to smile. But why should it have been written by Al here?
It wasn't, the old man said. I knew it wasn't. I was just ribbing him.
He dug Al with his elbow. His hot, wet breath blew into Al's face, stunning him. It had a dreadful, clammy quality, and he retreated reflexively. Indicating the couch, Harmon said to the old man, Sit down again, please. As he reseated himself, Ferguson said,
I can't get over old Al Miller being here.
He shook his head, still with the fixed grin on his face, the laughter that he could not seem to control. Harmon, also seating himself, said, Al's working for the organization, Jim. The old man's eyes flew wide open and bulged.
No,
he said. He seemed overcome with wonder and delight.
Al said, That's the way the ball bounces. I mean, it's all the same. It's in the game.
Hey, the old man said.
Again he lumbered to his feet and made his way over to Al. Nudging him again, he said in a loud voice,
We're all part of the same bunch.
He looked around at them all. Yes, Harmon said, smiling. I guess we are. He had a genial, tolerant expression on his face.
Listen,
the old man said to Harmon, going up to him and taking him by the sleeve.
Harmon, you know, Al and me weren't speaking for a while, you know that.
I didn't know that, Harmon said.
I was really sore at him, the old man said. But I'm not any more. He really let me down, but I don't care. I went by his lot, and it was hard for me to get over it, but I did. He was in pretty thick with my wife. They're a pair, the two of them.
He went on, but Al lost the sense of it. The words became jumbled. But anyhow, they were not directed to him. The old man was confiding to Harmon, standing close to him, muttering away in a wet, sputtering monotone. Coming over to Al, Bob Ross said,
Who is this old guy?
Al said, He owns a garage. Oh, said Ross, with a knowing expression.
I remember. Chris mentioned him. He's retired, isn't he?
Al said, No, he's just getting started.
I think I recall, Ross said.
He puffed several deep puffs on his pipe.
Well, I guess we don't get up to Petaluma today.